Yeah, I'm going to call the meeting to order. This is the House Judiciary Committee. It's November the 8th. And present are Representative Hanley, Martin, Ellis, and Donnelly. And we've been joined today by Representative Fran Ulmer of Juneau. And we welcome Representative Ulmer to the committee meeting. The purpose of today's hearing is to find out whether government is doing enough to protect public safety. And we're having this hearing because it's become obvious to observers in the criminal justice system that there are laws which our public safety officials just can't enforce because they don't have the resources. And it also appears that there are steps that could be taken to prevent crime that haven't been undertaken because of resource restraints or funding constraints. And during this hearing, we're going to try to find out exactly what is being done within the system and what gaps are out there, and then to hopefully take suggestions about what appropriate responses may be, and work on those and try to prepare something for the next legislative session. We're on teleconference today to, and we will be starting in Fairbanks. And one of the keys I want to stress to witnesses today is this is not so much a hearing about what is going on or out there as what's not going on. We want to find out where the gaps in the system are. We've got laws that aren't being enforced. We've got to know about that. The legislature needs to know about that. And we need to be able to that information, be able to craft a response to that, whether it's a budgetary response or whether it's to do away with archaic laws or laws that we simply are, it's nonsensical to have them on the books because we can't enforce them. So any suggestions along those lines would be in order, but we'd like to kind of maintain the focus of the hearing to the focus, which is where are the gaps out there, what's not being done. But with that, I'd like to go to Fairbanks and take some testimony from the Department of Law and the District Attorney, Harry Davis, and also like to invite District Attorney Ed McNally and the Assistant District Attorney, Steve Branchflower, to come forward here too. And we're going to use this off to the side here as our witness table. Hopefully that'll allow folks in back to have a chance to see the folks testifying rather than just the backs of their heads and be able to hear. I'm sorry we don't have a better speaker system in here. So everybody, there's plenty of room up front. You're encouraged to come up front to assist you if you need to hear more. So with that, I'm sorry. Should we do okay. So that will go to Fairbanks and Mr. Davis, would you like to give testimony to the committee?
This is Harry Davis. Yes, I certainly would be happy to provide information to the committee that affects the criminal justice system. My understanding, the focus of the committee primarily is the things that we're not doing in the system. At least in the Fairbanks area, the greatest crisis I see it is inadequate resources to effectively, at least in the city limits of Fairbanks, to effectively provide adequate protection. The inadequate police resources not only affect, obviously, the immediate access of the police on the street to prevent crime and to bring people to justice for the crimes they commit. It also has immediate effect upon my office regarding our ability to successfully prosecute cases. Because with the few police officers we have now, they're not able to do adequate investigations of their cases to allow us to have the cases in the condition they could be in order to prosecute. And we're right now in the process of skipping over certain things we shouldn't be skipping over, and sooner or later it's going to catch up with us. The District Attorney's Office in the state of Alaska do not have any independent investigatory capacity. They don't have investigators. So we must rely upon the police to do the follow-up investigations and the necessary interviews in order to allow us to prove our cases beyond a reasonable doubt. And at this point in time, the Fairbanks City Police Department doesn't even have the capacity to transcript the police report. We have a situation where we're simply reviewing witness statements and tapes. Sooner or later, and it's already beginning to affect the quality of our our cases means it takes longer to process cases. I mean, fewer cases to process. Combine this with the city attorney's office basically bailing out now or listing prosecutions. So by necessity, we're going to have to prioritize our case and take fewer cases in misdemeanor areas than we would like to do. But I'm surely not in any position, nor am I willing to legalize any criminal activity which are presently booked.
Okay. What is the situation in Fairbanks with collection of restitution for victims in misdemeanor cases? What kind of actions is the district attorney's office doing currently in that area?
Well, as you're probably aware, Representative Donnelly, under our present status of our laws, the ability to collect restitution is usually a very futile effort because we have to be able to prove the defendant's ability to pay. And quite frankly, we simply do not have the resources to do debtor examinations, which in essence what these things turn into, to try to enforce fines or restitution payments, especially in misdemeanor cases. We don't have the resources to do any felony cases. So if we don't get the money up front at the time of the arguments the court imposes the restitution order or the fine, there's probably very little being done to collect restitution.
Representative Donnelly, this is Representative Copeland, and it occurred to me that one of the reasons that we have for the halfway houses is to provide employment, certainly much easier to monitor the income of inmates at the halfway houses and to put part of that to restitution. However, as you know, the halfway houses are currently underutilized.
Okay. We do have pending legislation in the Senate Rules Committee, House Bill 90, which is an effort to make the collection of fines and restitution easier. If anybody has any additional suggestions of changes that could be made in that area, I'd certainly entertain them at any point during the hearing. I get a lot of constituent inquiries about bad checks. We have a statute that relates to bad checks. What are you doing in Fairbanks on enforcement of that statute?
Well, we're certainly still enforcing bad checks. In fact, it's been a case that could potentially be another form of theft. Unfortunately, as you're probably aware, the legislature has, in essence, legalized the conduct known as hiding. That makes it very difficult to prosecute these cases. We have to be able to show at the time the person wrote the bad check that they knew that it was going to be dishonored at the time that, in essence, demand was made on the check. This makes it very difficult to prosecute cases. And so we have an extensive pattern of bad checks, and we have an account to close. These cases require a substantial amount of investigation. They require a substantial amount of police resource, requiring us to get search warrants, bank records, and quite frankly, we cannot undertake them unless they are a substantial amount. Everything else is a matter of priority. Obviously, if our office enjoys a period of time where we have a lull in the crimes of violence, we haven't seen in quite a while, certainly can allocate more resources to bad check prosecution, minor theft prosecution.
Okay, Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A lot of things on bad checks and minor problems of this nature, minor relationship to rape, is told to me by the industry itself can take care of itself, and I know gas station people get burned a lot. They want to know what we could do to make the banking industry to do some of the things that are happening in lower 48. Like, if there's a new person in Alaska, they should begin their banking check with 100. Not with 1,325, which a crook knows that misleads any retailer into saying that the guy's been around. Some people can begin the banking check out with 3,000, which makes it sound like they've been in Alaska for a long time. But most of the bad check, from what I hear of retailers, is new people who come in and they're awful hard to trace, and they go around the banking system, makes it the responsibility of the retailer to do all the tracing. They seem to not help at all for what the retailer is saying you can do for us to stop this or decrease the potential of it in the first place.
Well, one of the possible areas that I've had suggested to me in this area is to bring the bad check issues into the civil system with some additional presumptions or making it easier for people to bring civil claims to that area. And if anybody has any suggestions in that area, I'd like to hear those also.
And you can see we changed to small court claims, and a lot of people are saying that the judge ruled in my favor, that this guy's a crook, he owes me, and that's nothing. We can do nothing about it. They can't even put a lien against the dividend check.
Well, I've had legislation in for years dealing with the exemptions and the yeah. liens, and it hasn't seemed to...
Of course, the bottom line, the retailer is the one that gets involved, and I think there's ways that we can get the industry to monitor itself rather than always passing laws.
One of the other questions I wanted to deal with the Fairbanks office was, you do a lot of interaction with the rural prosecution, from my memory, which may be wrong, of course. But I was wondering if you had any comments about prosecution staffing levels in rural Alaska. We had had some proposals that we'd heard quite a bit of testimony in the budget subcommittee on that, that there were some real needs out there.
Well, my office handles basically all of the prosecutions of rural Alaska, interior of Alaska, as well as the North Slope rural, so it gives experience in this area. But one of the biggest problems we have in rural Alaska is the extreme expense in delivering criminal justice service to rural Alaska. And again, if it goes down to allocation of resources, we have to look very carefully to undertaking cases, misdemeanor cases, which we would undertake in urban areas where we can prosecute for far less money. Typically in the North Slope borough, in Barrow, we have some problems this time. In prosecuting misdemeanor offenses, we simply don't have the adequate resources to do it. I've gone to the borough asking for assistance from the borough that so far I have not provided. There are two public defenders staffed at this time. We have only one prosecutor staffed. So in essence, we are only prosecuting felony offenses and very serious misdemeanor offenses that occur in North Slope borough at the time. So yes, it is a problem, an extensive problem. We need to look at alternatives to cut down the cost. One of the provisions we have in front of the Rules Committee now is to allow telephonic testimony in grand jury proceedings. If we can get that through the Criminal Rules Committee and get the Supreme Court to pass the rule, we can cut down our witness costs substantially. It was more money to deal with prosecutions in the hearing. If we could encourage the court to allow telephonic testimony at trial to a greater extent, we would be able to prosecute cases in remote areas in Wainwright, which we aren't really able to do at this time based upon the limited positive system to do so. So we need to look at using modern technology to allow us to deliver criminal justice services to the rural areas, which are, in my opinion, fully underserved at this point in time.
It's interesting you mentioned Wainwright. I was in Barrow a while back, and I went by and just watched some process, and I watched a telephonic case from Wainwright, but it was a plea bargain when the defendant had pled guilty, and I was curious if it hadn't have been how that would have been conducted, since both the public defender and the prosecutor were in Barrow, and the defendant was in Wainwright, and the judge was in Barrow.
Well, we can do pleas telephonically. We can't do trials at this point in time. We need to liberalize our rules to allow state to present witnesses telephonically, at least to problems of confrontation, I think, can be dealt with through technology by allowing, it probably will require some type of injection of the image of witness for it to be fixed in a requirement, but eventually we could have the technology to do that. Well, we do, so I just don't seem to have adequate amount of money to be able to transport witnesses here because this is the round trip here. Take it on a misdemeanor case, the cost is $5,000 to $10,000 to be able to prosecute one. We just don't have the resources to do that. It'll get transported.
Okay. Mr. Davis, maybe you could pull the microphone a little closer to you. It tends to break up if we drift. I probably am guilty of the same thing. How does plea bargaining relate to the lack of resources? Does the lack of resources encourage plea bargaining, charge bargaining?
No, obviously it does. When we're talking about plea bargaining, there's two, again, I like to distinguish between two. There's charge bargaining and then there's sentence bargaining. One occurs quite frequently, that is charge bargaining, and sentence bargaining occurs very infrequently. that's our policy of part of the law not to engage in. It's simply a matter of allocation of resource. When you get to the point that you can't process cases, you're more likely to agree to some concession that you would not like to agree to in order to process more cases. Obviously, the more serious the case is, the less likely you are to give a concession.
Is there any way we can put some sort of numerical data about what kind of crimes that are being people are being arrested for in rural Alaska, for that matter, other parts of Alaska too, that simply aren't being prosecuted or being dismissed? Is there any record that shows which ones are because of lack of, you know, cause or versus lack of resources?
Well, it's very hard to prove the negative. Because you're not going to have records of cases that we're not prosecuting or investigating or where the police aren't arresting. And obviously the police in certain areas, when we know that the particular cases, they don't have adequate resources to investigate, they often don't arrest. They have no paper trail of these kind of cases. But we certainly do have adequate records of all cases that are referred to our office and declined. In fact, those are readily available to legislature. They will vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. I would think that you would probably see a higher declination rate in rural areas than with the urban area.
Is the department doing any sort of analysis, or do they do any ongoing analysis of those cases to identify just what the level of this problem is?
Well, I think we know what the internally we know what the problem is from the standpoint of simply the cases we can't afford to prosecute. A lot of it has to do with the cooperation we get from the particular communities also. There's many communities in rural Alaska that are they want our presence, they want our assistance, and we will, obviously, it's like anything else, the cookie will get boiled, and we provide, I would think, a greater level of service to those communities than the other communities, which in essence do not want our presence. So I imagine you would see a variance based upon that factor as well.
Is there any sort of internal policy within the Attorney General's office or the Department of Law as a monetary level of a crime? Is there something right now you just basically say if it's below, you know, it's a theft case below so much, we just don't bother with it? Because I know we have that here in Anchorage as far as with the investigations and arrests.
No, we don't have, at least in the area of Alaska and the areas of Alaska, but there's no per se monetary amount put on it. We often look at many factors. We look at the particular offender involved as to whether or not that particular offender is a real problem in the village that are in our community. If the police identify that offender, we're more likely to go against that offender with our limited resources than we would someone who is a first offender who appears to have done a criminal act, which is an aberration of their personality rather than a force of criminality. So I don't think there is there's not any per se rules. As a manager of resources, I'm given X amount of money in my budget. I know that if I prosecuted every case that came to my office, especially if I gave 100% enforcement to all the laws of the state of Alaska and rural Alaska, I would probably be out of money within about 60 days. So I must make those decisions every day on allocation of resources, on extradition issues, as well as cases of undertaken prosecution.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sometimes I worry that the public feels, and I do definitely feel this too, that maybe the victim is being victimized twice. First, whatever happened, whether it be a rape or an assault, a beating up or something like that, and then the department, for whatever reason, feels, well, we're going to get this guy, but we'll have to give a lesser charge, and the lawyer knows it, and the criminal knows it, that these guys are always willing to bargain with this, and maybe we can get off with a misunderstanding, and he really slapped her, even though he abused her terribly. And I was wondering if we have developed an attitude by the criminals and by the lawyers that defend them that they're going to get off with a lesser charge. And at the same time, do you feel that maybe the public defender, the legislatures, had been perhaps taken care of then more financially or appropriations. I've heard this a number of times, that the poor victims have to go out and find lawyers to defend themselves because they can't do it, but then there's a lot of money available for the criminal and with the public defenders, and the criminal gets all kinds of protection. Do you find a conflict there, or are we giving different messages to the people?
Well, first, my office gives the highest priority possible to cases involving domestic violence victims and sexual assault victims. I would like to do a better job than we're doing. Certainly, the victim is victimized in our system. I can't change rules on that. Again, as far as allocation of resources, I mean, it's obvious Alaska provides greater due process rights to criminals than any other state, greater discovery rights, and a greater allocation of resources to the public defense, to the public defenders or the public advocates. And I'm not saying it's bad, but I'm saying it's expensive. And the only way you could overcome that is basically to allocate financial resources to prosecution and the police. And what I see happening is that our allocation to our police agencies and our prosecutorial agencies are not keeping up with the burden we have to overcome in order to service because of the amount of problems we have now with resources, but dealing with the particular way the playing field is with a slanted. It's going to, you know, in essence, what I say, we have a Rolls-Royce system that's based on a Model T budget, and as long as we have that, we're going to have investment done to fix up the problem.
Yeah, as far as the victims, we used to have victims' assistance. There were a couple in the budget, and I know they got cut out a few years back. Did you want to make any comment about that?
Well, you know, on the positive side, I think the legislature certainly has been responsive to victims' rights. We've made tremendous progress in the last few years recognizing rights. And again, of course, you pass laws giving them these rights, but we have a limited amount of resources to deliver them. My office, I allocate as much resources as I can regarding our paralegals to provide the victim witness assistance. Unfortunately, though, they, because of the caseload, they have to basically spend a tremendous amount of their time simply allocating their resources, getting witnesses available to testify in all our cases. We can't spend the time we'd like to spend. But it's simply a matter of, again, allocating the resources.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to go back to Representative Copeland's comment about, since we're on victims again, I hesitate because this is a little out of the focus of the hearing, but let's go back to the comment about lack of restitution to victims due to underutilization of the halfway houses and soft beds in the system. And maybe there are folks here that are more familiar with the corrections budget, but to what extent are those beds underutilized at this time, and why? Is that a new trend in our corrections policy to underutilize those beds? And because, you know, it is a concern about victims not being, I mean, Nilo's right, that's where you can monitor people's income and they work, and you can begin to, or go a little ways into making a victim more whole after the crime. So can anybody comment on that?
Sure. Committee Council wants to make a comment, and then we'll go to Representative Palmer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellis, the only comment I would have is that's one of the subjects that we've specifically asked the Department of Corrections to address this afternoon. There's information in your notebooks relating to that issue, and Mr. Pruitt tells me that he is prepared to respond to issues like that. So that is something that I think needs to be addressed and will be addressed this afternoon.
Thank you. Just very briefly, I chair the Corrections Subcommittee of House Finance, and we are having a subcommittee meeting in Fairbanks on Tuesday. One of the things that we plan to be discussing with the Department of Corrections is this issue, because as you may or may not remember, the House Finance Committee added additional community corrections beds in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, Kenai, and Bethel, which were vetoed by the governor. At the same time, this administration is planning to send about 100 prisoners outside to Oklahoma or someplace because they say that they've run out of bed space. There is bed space in the halfway houses in Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. And we're very concerned that there has been a shift in the Department of Corrections policy away from halfway houses at the very time when they need them the most, not only because of prison overcrowding problems, but also because of some points that have been raised by Representative Copen, and that is that these facilities present an excellent opportunity for not only the individual to work and be able to reintegrate into society, but also be able to pay off restitution, pay off fines, pay for the cost, they pay partially for the cost of the halfway house. So in addition to the discussion this afternoon, I just wanted you all to know that we will be pursuing this at some length in the House Finance Subcommittee Tuesday in Fairbanks.
Yeah, I'd like an update, if we could, on the situation. I understand the city of Fairbanks, similar to the city of Anchorage, has either actually or threatened to stop prosecuting certain crimes under the city code and turn them over to the state for prosecution. And I wonder, has that actually happened, and are you, what types of crimes are those, and are you actually prosecuting some now that the city has dropped?
Effectively, the city of Fairbanks has repealed all of its ordinances. The only ordinance that remains the domestic violence ordinance, and I expect that they'll be repealing that in the future. What this has done is shift all of the shoplifting cases to us, the disorderly conduct cases. We are already doing all the DWI prosecutions for the city. What has happened in the past, and I'm afraid may happen again, is that we will have all this additional responsibility and prosecution with no additional allocation of resource to undertake this burden. And what this means is we again have to find more cases than we would like to. We're not going to be able to prosecute, spend the time that we need to spend on the case in excess of prosecute cases we do undertake. This is something the state and the municipalities must address as to who's going to be responsible for this, and then we must allocate the resources to whatever agency is going to be doing.
Okay. I'd like to come back to Anchorage here, and Mr. Davis, feel free to just jump in if there's other things you specifically want to comment on, and just ask Mr. McNally if he had any comments, or Mr. Branchflower. At this point, I think you see what kind of questions we're interested in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you're talking about gaps in the system and where the greatest gaps are, I think that there are two on the budgetary issue that are virtually before you right now. One is terribly important to rural Alaska. The other is terribly important to urban Alaska. And doing those in reverse order, you've just talked to my colleague, Harry Davis, about this question of municipal prosecution. And I think what you'll find in both Fairbanks and Anchorage and any other city is a willingness by the prosecutors to make the highest and best effort to prosecute the most important cases before them. But there are limited resources. And these offices have traditionally been exercising a substantial amount of discretion in determining the highest and best use of those resources. In Anchorage, in my view, you've got a system that's working right now. It is not broken. The municipal prosecutors are able to bring intense focus to the cases that are most important to the municipality of Anchorage. And they focus on those kinds of cases. You know, a DWI case is as important a case as they get, and is not have the problem in a DA's office where a DWI, which is very important and a high priority, obviously still does not rise to the same level as a multiple homicide. And there is a three-tiered system in Anchorage. The municipal prosecutors, the district attorney's office, and the United States attorney's office. And each of them devotes, in my opinion, the correct kind and nature of resources to the crimes that are occurring in this jurisdiction. If Anchorage were to face a situation like Harry Davis and his colleagues have run into in Fairbanks, you're talking about a change in the budget of my office of probably hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of dollars. If the same situation were to occur in Anchorage, I would have, our office would be faced with the same situation Mr. Davis's office is, which is taking on a whole additional category of crimes with no resources and having to decline many of those new cases, as well as having to decline some of the existing cases that had they not had the new burden, they would have been able to go forward with. That's the urban question. And the state of Alaska, working with the municipalities and others, has to make a resource decision about where they want these funds to come from. There is no question that the work has to be done, and there's no question that there are capable people in both offices, both municipal and DAs, that are able, ready, and willing to do the work. The rural issue, where there's a terrible gap problem, involves contract jails. And I haven't heard that mentioned this morning, and I didn't see it on your agenda, but I have no doubt that many of the committee members are aware of this situation. In Onalaska, in Barrow, in Cordova, and many other areas, the local jails have made a decision that they will be charging the state of Alaska, meaning the Department of Public Safety, as much as $600, $650, $700, $750 a night for each person who was held in jail. What that means is, since the state of Alaska has not allocated resources for that kind of expenditure, and that's an extraordinary number, I have no familiarity with the basis for how that number is obtained. We have a situation, for instance, in Alaska, where there is a distinct unwillingness on the part of the local community to house state prisoners in jail who may be dangerous to themselves or to others. These are cases where traditionally we would seek adequate bail to ensure the community safety, their own safety, and that they'll comply with the orders of the court. And we have been asked by various components of the system to seek lower bail so that people aren't spending nights in jail and not costing the state so much money. It's a position the Department of Law, as an advocate, is not in a very good position to take because of the danger that is represented by some of these people being released. And my colleague, John Murphy, is probably better able to talk about this in detail, but it's a real problem. It's percolating out there. And similar to the municipal versus state prosecutions question, the real issue is not what needs to be done, it's who's going to pay for it. The job has to be done. The question is where the funds come from. And Harry Davis may be able to cast some light on this with regard to Barrow or some of the areas where his colleagues are working as well.
Okay. Can you just identify yourself and your title?
Yes. My name is Edward McNally. I'm the district attorney in Anchorage. I've been here 6 months, and with me here today to present views are the chief of our intake unit and the felony unit, Steve Branchflower, who's an assistant district attorney, and also assistant district attorney Stephanie Rhodes, who's the chief of our newly created sexual assault and domestic violence unit.
Okay, thank you. Representative Martin.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I want to bring to the attention of the committee, because I sit on the budget and audit committee, and report that have been, I think, officially released. I'm just thinking now it's improved, so maybe it's still confidential, but it does show the problems that the Department of Correction is having with contract jails. And it's a very enlightening report, and I think, like Mr. McNally said, that some of these prices have gotten very high. High price is $880 a day, and there was a statement there that perhaps some local governments are using this as a source of revenues, not necessarily to keep the prisoner comfortable. But that report is available. It would be very enlightening to our committee. Thank you.
Okay. Now, we've gotten letters from the Bethel area about sexual assault cases and sexual abuse of a minor cases that have been lost for speedy trial violations. Is that due to understaffing in those areas, or?
I spoke yesterday to District Attorney Ben Heron in Bethel about some of these issues, and unfortunately we did not have an opportunity to fully explore them. The one thing that we can say candidly, I know that one of the questions is whether there are sufficiently experienced prosecutors in Bethel, and having spent a good part of the 6 months I've been here in recruiting both for the Anchorage DA's office and for the rural DA's offices, I can certainly tell you firsthand something you already no doubt know. It is extremely difficult
to hire what the Attorney General has asked all of his colleagues to hire, which are, quote, first-round draft choices. It is extremely difficult to draw first-round draft choices to some of Alaska's rural communities for reasons that are familiar to everyone in this room. They have to do with climate, isolation, the challenges of the job, and so forth. And to give one example, in Bethel, the Department of Law hired a very able and talented young prosecutor who took and unfortunately did not succeed in passing the bar exam once, and then that occurred a second time, and by department policy that prosecutor is no longer in a position to serve the state there. And that is just one example of the kinds of problems that we run into in a community like Bethel that is less acute in Anchorage. And there is no question that that particular suggestion is true. It is extraordinarily difficult for the state to draw, whether from inside, where of course there is no law school, or from outside, the caliber of prosecutor that these kinds of cases deserve.
Well, so you can't really say. You think that you would have the same resources you have now, but just different personnel, that wouldn't happen?
I don't think it's quite as simple as that, because personnel obviously do make a difference. And I can speak better for Anchorage's involvement in the interior than I can for my colleagues in Bethel. The unit that we've just created that I've referred to, the Sexual Assault and Domestic Violence Unit, in the past, Anchorage has had a variety of misdemeanor unit attorneys who then, as now, service a good number of outlying communities. On Alaska is one, Cordova is another, St. Paul and Sandpoint, etc. And in the past, these misdemeanor attorneys, who are among the less experienced prosecutors in Anchorage, have screened sexual assault and sexual abuse of a minor cases themselves. When I proposed to Stephanie Rhodes, who's here, that she head this unit, she had several requests, and one of the first and most important was she insisted that in order to better service the interior, that all of those Bush cases that Anchorage is responsible for that involve felony crimes of sexual assault or sexual abuse of a minor be screened by the trained intake attorneys in the intake felony unit rather than by misdemeanor attorneys. And that should bring a new level of expertise in supervising investigations, in seeing problems early, and just as important, because I think it goes to the heart of the question you're asking, a consistency, so that we're as confident as we can be that the level of justice that's dispensed in a rural community is as close as possible to the level that is available given resource limitations in a city like Anchorage.
Mr. Representative Copeland, I'm interested in one structural question. On investigation, does the department rely strictly on the on public safety and the police, or do you have your own investigators to follow up and develop the case?
The criminal division in Anchorage has no investigators in its employ. Everybody in our office is either a prosecutor or someone who is employed to assist the prosecutor in bringing those cases to trial and working with victims and witnesses and the other considerations we have to address. So the answer to your question is no, there are no investigators in any of the priority areas, including sexual assault in the Anchorage DA's office. We do rely on the local police, whether in Anchorage or elsewhere, and on the Alaska State Troopers to do the investigations. And I should add, and I'm sure you'll have an opportunity to speak with him, Colonel Murphy, the director of the Troopers, also made a commitment to enhance prosecution in this area to try and close one of the gaps we're talking about today when he expanded the Criminal Investigation Bureau from 5 investigators to 7, and by designating 2 of them to specifically be responsible for developing increased expertise in the area of sexual investigations.
But in general, are the police, especially the local police, adequately aware of the needs of the prosecutor's office in evidence, in accumulating evidence and the like? And how closely do you, Do the prosecutors work with the police who are working on a case?
Representative, I'll answer that briefly, and we have a more expert person here, and I think I should let her somewhat address this question. There are cases of sexual assault or sexual abuse of a minor that receive a good deal of prosecutorial attention. The theory behind our new unit is somewhat to model the very successful homicide response team that Steve Branchflower and Mike Grimes and others have put together to make sure that, both the investigators and the prosecutors are looking toward a jury trial when they approach an investigation. However, with many of these cases, we, the prosecutors, whether here or in outlying areas, do not learn about the case until the investigation is essentially completed. But let me introduce ADA Stephanie Rhodes and let her respond to that question in more detail.
Representative Copeland, I don't want to get too far off the track here. We're really trying to figure out what's not getting done out there and not what is being done so much as where the holes are. So, Stephanie, if you wanted to go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In Anchorage, we're really doing quite well on this issue because we have established this unit and we are doing much better, I believe, at this time in coordinating the efforts of law enforcement and the prosecutor's office. I think the difficulties are in the small rural offices. And to address the question about cases, sexual assault cases and abuse cases going by the board to Rule 45, I'd like to also mention that, first of all, it's not only the experience level of the prosecutor, because particularly Bethel was mentioned, I believe the prosecutors there are fairly experienced considering the location and the type of people, the type of experience level we tend to draw to those locations. I believe the problem in Bethel is a resource problem. They simply do not have the person power to do the work. I think there's also a systemic problem there because in Anchorage, generally speaking, the police do not charge the case. In other words, they do not issue the charging document that begins Rule 45 running. And in the Bush locations, that is not true. In the Bush locations, the local law enforcement do often file the charging document, which means that by the time the prosecutor gets the case to deal with it, Rule 45 has already begun. And in a lot of cases, this is not necessary. And so I think that there are a couple of problems that rural locations face that Anchorage doesn't face, both systemically and in terms of resources. Bethel, for example, used to have a paralegal who was law trained. He had attended law school and he was capable of drafting quite a bit of motions practice. The office no longer has that, so that responsibility has fallen to the attorneys in the office, who also are responsible for handling all the court appearances and trying all the cases out there and screening all the cases out there and assisting law enforcement with their questions and issues. So I think there's quite a number of different things apart from the experience level of the prosecutors in rural locales that contribute to cases going by the boards.
You mentioned some systemic things. If there are things like that that you think we could do legislation to address, if it's appropriate, I'd really welcome any comments at a later time, any written comments or suggestions. We certainly want to help out any way we could there.
Thank you.
Representative Martin.
Mr. Chairman, on that point there, over the years we've had a lot of comment made about the legislature's lack of passing a meaningful conspiracy law. And I think it was last session or maybe two sessions ago, we did pass something pertaining to this problem. But I'm very weak on my knowledge on that. I wonder if Mr. McNally could give us an idea of where we stand on conspiracy laws. Are we helping your department to do what needs to be done, or are we very weak in that law?
Communication problems
different types of
police and probation. That policeman who got killed a number of years ago was they didn't investigate, didn't contact probation to find out that the guy was on parole and he was supposed to be picked up and because they suspected he picked up a firearm. They just weren't monitoring the radio network. Since then, they have five that the Anchorage Police Department has, ACD has saved to it. That is the computer, the only place possible, but they didn't.
Okay, Rep. Representative Copeland, and your transmission is breaking up a lot, but Representative Martin, you know, I've sponsored conspiracy law a couple of times in the past, and I'm real interested in it. I just think it's kind of outside the scope of the resources and other issues that we're addressing here. It'd be a way to get into different things. It might be a tool. I can see it as a tool for prosecutions, which is one of the reasons I've always supported and sponsored it. I think we're going to be getting into that maybe at a later time. If you want to make a quick comment, Mr. McNally.
My quick comment is that if the focus of today is resources and their allocation, there is no question that there are substantive laws that could be added to the books in Alaska that would not change the budget, that would change the amount of work we're able to do, that would give you, the legislature, and the people of Alaska a lot more bang for the buck that's already out there. Conspiracy is one good example of that. Permitting hearsay testimony in the grand jury is another good example of that. Making an automatic waiver for 16 and 70-year-old felons in unclassified and A felons is another example of that, where for the same amount of prosecutors and the same amount of judges and the same amount of police, you will have far more effective law enforcement. And these are tools that are constitutional. They've been tested elsewhere. And in fact, they're being used in Alaska, have been, by Alaska prosecutors and Alaska juries for decades down the street in the federal courthouse.
Good summary. I agree with a lot of that. I had one more question on cases, rural cases that the Anchorage DA does handle. The Anchorage DA handles the Unalaska cases, and we've been getting a lot of complaints about failure to prosecute in that region. And previously, the acting Anchorage district attorney said it was a lack of funding. What's the current status of the Unalaska situation?
Unalaska is a difficult area of discussion for a lot of reasons. My first month here, I paid a visit to John Salemi's office. He's here today. And one of his colleagues, who's no longer employed by the Public Defender's Office, was responsible for Unalaska, and I asked him about the problem. And this was a very able lawyer, also a public servant, who was personally convinced that a lot of what is called, quote, the situation in Unalaska was one that had been somewhat created by members of the community who were interested in bringing more focus to a problem that wasn't more acute there than elsewhere. In fact, this able lawyer was convinced that the situation in Alaska, in terms of the number of cases that get charged, the number of cases that get brought to trial, was in fact quite on an even level with other similarly situated communities in Alaska. Now, I don't have before me numbers to show whether that is true or not true. I do know this. We in Anchorage have devoted literally the best available prosecutors we have to spend time there, and they go there quite a bit. Assistant District Attorney John Novak, who's one of the new members of our drug unit, has been out there again and again in the last several months, taking case after case to trial. We've now assigned a new Assistant District Attorney in many ways the most experienced police investigator in our office. His name is Don Kitchen. He's the first Anchorage police officer to ever be named a district attorney in Alaska, and he has a total of 9 years of police experience. So he's a long ways from a rookie. And they're out there week after week doing the work that's expected of them, and we do not have a measurable indication that the problem in Unalaska is different than the problem in, for example, Cordova or other such communities.
Thank you. Mr. Branchflower, maybe you could address to the degree that the charge and sentence bargainings are related to both resources of availability.
Well, it's somewhat of a broad question, and I think that I think you started off this morning's hearing by inquiring whether anyone had any statistics, and I did bring some statistics. And these statistics are current as of the end of last month. They are Anchorage statistics. Davis Fairbanks commented that the central office in Juneau does have an accurate accounting statewide. I don't have a specific form. As of the end of September, we had in the Anchorage office 1,354 felony defendants, which had been screened into the office and whose cases had been presented to the grand jury and are awaiting trial. We had 76 felony charges pending in the felony intake unit. Out of 1,278 screened, 76% were accepted as felonies, meaning about 24% were declined. That's our decline rate. This is the highest acceptance rate in the state. We average in Anchorage, if you do the math, it comes out to be about 4 new felonies every day of the week for every day of the year. This is a tremendous number of felonies which need to be professionally and quickly processed by the felony intake unit. If you look at the conviction rate, what comes out at the other end, I don't know the precise figure, I believe it's up in the very high 80s. So just to summarize, we have a very, very large volume of cases. We decline a minimal number of cases, and the conviction rate is amongst the highest in the country. We do engage, as Mr. Davis mentioned, we do engage in charge bargaining in the Anchorage office, not in traditional plea bargaining. That system has worked very, very well. A few years ago, I implemented a new stage in the prosecution, which is only seen here in Anchorage, which is called the pre-indictment phase. Essentially, the notion of the pre-indictment hearing, which is held twice a week, is to stop Criminal Rule 5 from running. One of the problems that Ms. Rhodes mentioned was the delay in getting cases to the grand jury. People who are charged in the push, by the time their cases are sent to Anchorage and those cases are processed, there's oftentimes a substantial delay. One of the things that she did not mention is that it is the problem of Rule 5. Rule 5 requires a grand jury presentation of those persons who are charged with felonies if they remain in custody within for longer than 10 days. If you are arrested today, your case has to be presented to the grand jury 10 days from today. If you post bail is 20 days. If your case is not presented to the grand jury, your case is dismissed. And so when you have these push cases come into Anchorage, especially the sexual assault cases or screening, the mere transportation and the time it takes for the paperwork to catch up is oftentimes about 10 days. So we have this, a terrible problem with defendants automatically getting out of jail. And one of the things that the legislature may well want to look at is an extension statute which addresses Criminal Rule 5 to give Bush cases a longer period of time to get processed. If we had 15 to 20 days, that would alleviate the situation in terms of Bush. So the bottom line, to summarize, is that we have a tremendous number of cases here in Anchorage, and our office has been able to cope with that high number and to do a very effective job.
Okay. Ms. Rhodes, did you want to make any... Did you wish to do any follow-up comments at all?
No.
Okay. Well, we really thank you all for being here today, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Representative.
If I might ask you a quick question. Mr. Branchflower, you see a tremendous number of cases in your capacity as the screening attorney. And the question I have for you, and perhaps your statistics would give us some insight, is the percentage of successful convictions of the original charge. Experientially, what I hear often from constituents is that in the process of the charge bargaining, a lot of folks that are actually charged with doing X are later convicted and sentenced for doing Y, and that X and Y do not equal each other. That is to say, they are convicted and sentenced on a lesser charge. And I assume that there are a number of reasons why that happens, including the lack of resources, the lack of adequate time to really prove the case, the inadequacy of witnesses, all kinds of things. But I particularly hear that with regard to sexual offenses, sexual assault, sexual abuse of a minor cases. Could you just comment on that for us, please? Because I am concerned about the number of people who perhaps are not being appropriately sentenced, appropriate in light of what they actually did in terms of their crime against society.
Well, Representative Ulmer, I can make, I suppose I can respond by saying that there are two main reasons why charges are adjusted. One has to do with the sufficiency of evidence. That is, when a police officer brings a case to us, we are required to measure that evidence utilizing the same standard that the jury would use. That is, does this evidence rise to a level of proof beyond reasonable doubt? If it does, all other things being equal, then there's no reason not to charge, especially the sort of cases that you've identified, which are very high priority cases with us. The other consideration, in addition to the burden of proof, has to do with sort of a number of lesser considerations, resource considerations, desires of the victim and or that person's family, the amount of time that it might take to try the case, and so forth. And those considerations sometimes lead to a consolidation of counts or a reduction in degree of crime in exchange for a plea. The kinds of cases that you've identified are amongst those that are the most serious considered in our office, and where the amount of anxiety visited on victims is the greatest. And so we try to give deference to the victim's wishes as much as possible. That may not be a completely satisfactory answer, but in the time that we do have here, I think that it pretty generally summarizes our handling of those sorts of cases.
Mr. Chairman, may I offer some concluding remarks?
Please.
First of all, I want to thank you for inviting us here today. I have worked, and other colleagues in my office have worked closely with most of the members of your committee, Representative Martin, Representative Ulmer, and your able staff counsel, and we appreciate the opportunity. In describing the problems in our professional way, I don't want to present any illusions about the nature of the problem. It is certainly our clear view that we in prosecution, as well as our colleagues in investigative law enforcement, do not play on a level playing field. The substantive laws are extremely difficult for us to overcome. The budget limitations are very real. And despite the fact that thanks to your efforts, the efforts of the administration, the Anchorage DA's office now has new and more staff than it has ever had in the past, it is still a decidedly uphill battle. It is extraordinarily difficult to train and retain committed career prosecutors like the man sitting next to me. Steve Branchflower is one of about four in Anchorage who have really gone the distance. But by and large, beyond that, after 3 years or 2 years of prosecuting, some of Alaska's most talented lawyers have another place to go, and they go. And it's not because their salaries aren't high enough. It's because of the hours. It's because of the challenge. It's because of the nature of the work. And there are things that can be done, in part with budget, but probably more clearly in substantive law, that can change that, that can level the playing field more, and permit those of us who you have out there who are committed to a level playing field to protect the people of the state better than we're able to right now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank all three of you. Thank you. We're going to move our way through the agenda, and I'd like to call Chief O'Leary and Mr. Wolf. And Mr. Wolf, you had other folks you wanted to bring with you?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's a promotion.
I have with me Michelle Hill, who is our victim witness coordinator for the domestic violence, and Mr. Wallace, who was my deputy.
Great. Why don't you just all come up and have a seat, and then maybe you could each introduce yourself on the tape for the record. So.
Thank you.
Because I don't think it would pick you up that long. Is there enough chairs?
Yeah. Mr. Maltus has to leave because he has commitments on another matter, and because we're late.
I'm sorry.
That's fine. But so, my name is Jim Wolf. I'm Chief Prosecutor for the Anchorage Municipal Prosecutor's Office. With me is Michelle Haley. She is our Victim Witness Coordinator of Domestic Violence.
I'd really welcome any opening remarks, Chief O'Leary, yourself, Mr. Wolf. If you want to talk about, you know, I guess you're getting a feel for what we're looking at today. We want to help. We want to be in a position to have the knowledge to help any way we can. And so it's
we think that, and I think everybody on the committee thinks that the folks in our criminal justice system, our prosecutors and police, are doing an excellent job with the resources they have. We want to find out where you need more resources or where you need any legislative assistance with laws or other changes like that.
Representative Donnelly, I appreciate the opportunity to come here. And this is something that needs to be done. I agree there are problems that exist within the system that can hopefully be corrected. I'm not sure. First of all, what I'd like to do is start out explaining a little bit about my office, what we do, and what our caseload is like, and what my staffing is like, so you have some idea of what we have. First of all, our office handles all cases, all misdemeanor violations submitted by the Anchorage Police Department that could occur within the municipality of Anchorage. We presently, this year, will probably receive or have submitted to us somewhere in the area between 8,000 to 10,000 cases. I have presently a staff of 7 attorneys, which include myself and my deputy. I have 5 active trial attorneys. I have two interns that assist us, as well as a victim witness coordinator. I have a support staff of 8 individuals. The cases that are submitted to our office are basically under the criminal code of the Anchorage Criminal Code under Title 8, as well as the Anchorage Traffic Code Title 9. Our priorities in our caseload, are DWIs and domestic violence assault. Those are the ones that we channel most of our resources into in attempting to handle or work with this situation. As the body can see, we have on board 1 victim witness coordinator. Now, the stats that we have indicate that last year, about 42% of the assault cases that we took in resulted in domestic violence. And that is increasing. That number, I believe, was around 454 cases that we received that were domestic violence. This year, we're projecting it will probably run into about 588 cases of domestic violence. Domestic violence and DWI do tax a lot of our resources. Now, this committee is looking for areas in which we are unable to proceed or where there is a lack of getting the problem resolved because of lack of funding. One of the things we are unable to do, basically because of logistics, basically because of limited funding, is to follow through with all the requirements in the Victim Rights Act. I brought here, I believe, the thing. For example, there are requirements that we notify victims that they be present at a sentencing hearing. Basically, in misdemeanor prosecution, there is no sentencing hearing. There is just not the time or allocation for that. Let me give you an example. Every day, there are presently about 30 to 40 cases submitted for trial. That's what's called a trial call. That is, they come into court the day before trial. 30 or 40 cases on trial call, of which we usually have available 3 or 4 attorneys, as well as a limited number of courtrooms and judges. If, in fact, all of them were to proceed, we would be unable to proceed, period. That's easy, simple. Many of them changed their plea based on plea bargaining, based on charge bargaining or sentence bargaining. And as a result, there are a number of cases that are funneled into courtrooms for what's called change of pleas. They are rapid hearings in which basically a limited number of facts is presented to the court so that it may determine that there is an adequate reason or basis for accepting the plea and sentencing. In domestic violence, we almost always try to encourage that the defendant, not encourage, that we order the defendant to go to counseling concerning anger control. But there is no probation officer involved as far as a formal misdemeanor probation officer involved, nor is there any sentencing hearing or any sentence hearing formula that the court can review, because it just doesn't have the time. What the system does is that basically we order the defendant through to the counseling program. There may be other conditions of sentencing. With the ASAP program, the Alcohol Safety and Action Program, being our monitoring, it acts as an intermediary where the defendant is ordered to go to that program, and then will be determined which anger control program will be sent to. There are two in Anchorage. One is called the Male Awareness Program with the Awake Shelter, and then there's the Mental Alliance Program. Depending on the availability of resources with those programs, which are limited as well, will depend on where they go. Those programs, because they're limited in their resources, that's why we have adopted the Alcohol Safety and Action Program for them to go to. But there is no real hearing, and we don't have the time, basically, to bring in a victim for a sentencing hearing. I just don't have the resources available to me to inform all of the victims of the consequences of the case at the time. We try to inform them. What we did at one point, send letters to the victims indicating that the defendant had been in fact convicted, what the sentence was. Unfortunately, we were unable to continue with that process because we don't have the funds allocated to meet that demand, to meet the demand of sending this correspondence out. What Ms. Haley does, in fact, this is when a case is brought to our attention and we accept it for prosecution, she tries to make notice, she tries to make contact with the victim immediately or as soon as possible to the time of incident to bring her in an interviewer to go over the case to determine if there is any additional evidence and to explain to her the criminal justice system to try and answer some questions. There will most likely be no additional contact with the victim during that period of time because we just don't have the personnel to continue to send out all this paper flow.
So these are all misdemeanors, right?
Right. But because of, I mean, and I think this committee understands that the domestic violence is a very important, I mean, it has to be handled in a misdemeanor level and given a lot of attention. Because my experience, I've been a prosecutor in this city since 1976. My experience with domestic violence is that if we don't handle it at a misdemeanor level and try to do it correctly, it winds up with the district attorney as a felony because the violence increases. So we try to funnel a lot of resources, but we're only limited. We're limited to what we can do by the amount of personnel that's available. Recently, the new Victims' Rights Act has created a tremendous paper burden on our office based on the requirements that the court has placed on us in filing documents with the court. For example, it has required that the victims, witnesses, addresses, and phone numbers be considered private and confidential. As a result, the court has required before filing any document with the court, any document, that we have to submit an additional form or incorporate within that document another form indicating that the information within the body of that document is now confidential. I have not had any additional staff to require to do that paperwork, so that is causing additional burdens. So there are problems that occur when the legislature passes laws like this for all good intent, but there is no additional funding coming to my office through the city assembly. And that's causing some problems. There was a question concerning restitution, and most of our restitution cases come out of DWIs. Defendant creates problems as far as damaging property or injury. The problem we have with restitution is that we're required to follow the guidelines established by the Supreme Court. If a defendant is ordered to make restitution by the court, and in most cases the court orders uninsured loss. In other words, if we're talking about property damage, whatever is not covered by insurance, that is the deductible, will be required, the defendant will be required to pay. the defendant is given a certain amount of time to pay that. If he doesn't pay it, if he or she doesn't pay that, then we receive, we have sent a notice to the victim. If the victim contacts us and let us know they have not received restitution, we will either send a warning letter to have them try to correct that, if not, file a petition with the court to revoke the defendant's probation. The court is limited in what it can do based on the Supreme Court decisions that if it finds a willful violation on the part of the defendant in not paying restitution, then an action could be taken, which basically is to impose any suspended time or fine. If the court finds there is no willful violation, for example, the defendant comes in and says, I'm unemployed, I haven't been able to work, I don't have any money, I can't pay the restitution, then the court, all it can do is extend the period of time to make restitution. So what we have done is, we have done one thing, two things. One, we go forward with trying to get the restitution. We also encourage the victim to proceed civilly in order to obtain their appeal. But again, we're limited in that aspect. And again, we rely on the victim because in cases where the court orders restitution, we do send a letter to the victim, but we rely on the victim to make contact with us because that's all the resources I have available to do it. If the victim does not contact us, then basically we will not take any action.
My understanding is there are certain levels of property crimes that simply just aren't addressed now in Anchorage. And I think, you know, your explanation of your priorities makes a lot of sense to me. I think it seems like they're very well placed. And just from a resource point of view, my personal experience is that I was once told in the system that crimes like thefts or of under $500 or so, they're just not worked on. They simply don't have the resources to do them. Is there some sort of monetary policy like that now?
No, not in our office at this time. If there are budget cuts that I am looking at, that I may look at, and I don't know if there are or not, but if there are, then yeah, I probably will have to. At this time, for example, shoplifting, we have levels of sensing that we've done. We've reduced the penalties for shoplifting under $5, so it's an infraction, the maximum fine of $300. Where a person is taking alleged value of property between $5 and $50, maximum penalty is 90 days in jail. Over that is a year and $5,000. But we haven't limited it to a value. In other words, we accept cases in which the value is $7.
Would I get that feedback from the system then, that there was a dollar amount policy level when crimes were reported, just basically, well, it just doesn't fit our criteria, we don't have the time to investigate it? I mean, which not only have I had constituents get that feedback, but I've had personal feedback to that level. And I'm not saying that it's not necessary given the lack of resources, I'm just saying, where are we at now with that?
I really can't say as far as the case, not except in cases under 500. I'm not sure if that's another
Chief O'Leary.
Mr. Chairman, I think you're asking the wrong person. There are absolutely criteria. Not only will we not accept those kinds of cases, we have criteria in all of our levels of response. I think if you take a look at page 2 of the summary report that I gave you that is indicative of the crimes that are occurring in Anchorage, we focus on high priority crimes, homicides, robberies, sexual assaults, burglaries, things of that nature. But nonviolent property-related crimes, we absolutely establish a limit. There's a $500 limit beyond which we'll take a police report over the phone. We won't send an officer. We have a $5,000 aggregate limit for checks. If you don't have $5,000 worth of bad checks, we're not going to work the case. So yes, there are absolutely written, established criteria that we follow and have for years on those kinds of cases, which is why Mr. Wolf's office doesn't see them.
They don't get that part.
They never make it there.
Okay. Representative Martin.
Yes, thank you. This is for Mr. Wolf, for Chief O'Leary. But do you draw a line when there is a, you talk about $5 of a theft in a grocery store, what about the post and weeds detail that had the bogus check for $200 or landlord that was ripped off? I was hearing a case the other day where someone busted into her apartment and did probably $1,000 worth of damage, and she didn't know what recourse to go to, and that couldn't help her either. Does your department handle that, or is it just a lost thing?
Well, if this individual had contacted the police department and then they went out and investigated it and submitted a case to us, we would look at it and to make a determination whether or not there was sufficient evidence to prosecute. I mean, there is a fine line at times when a matter can be brought into the criminal system or whether or not it's a civil matter. And if the case is submitted to our office, we'll review it. But again, depending on the resources and where the case lies as far as into the legal system, will depend on whether or not the matter gets prosecuted. But our arm of investigation, we rely on the Anchorage Police Department. Like the District Attorney's Office, we have no investigators in our office, so we must rely on them to bring the case to us. Without that, we would not be able to proceed. And in fact, many people come to our office asking, I would like this case prosecuted, and we advise them that they have to go through the police department and law enforcement before a case can be considered by our office.
Did you get a second? Thank you.
Mr. Wolf, did you want to continue any further comments?
No, unless there's any additional questions.
Okay, Representative Wolf.
Thank you. Just a brief question regarding the domestic violence misdemeanor cases. Would you hazard a guess at what percentage of the convicted offenders spend any time in jail whatsoever?
I don't have the stats available, but I would say a small percentage of them actually serve jail time. And there's probably a number of reasons for that. One of the reasons is that we're still obligated to convict the defendant beyond a reasonable doubt. In many of these cases, the victim in domestic violence, because of the nature of the type of crime, winds up either wanting the charges dropped or becoming more of a foe to the prosecution rather than an ally. As a result, there are many instances where we, in order to channel the defendant into counseling, because I consider that to be more important, in an attempt to get a conviction, and the assistance of the victim in these type of cases will indicate as part of the charge or part of the sentence that jail time may not be offered. On the premise that the defendant successfully complete the rehabilitation program. And without that, if we go to trial and we don't have the full cooperation of the victim, who is usually the only eyewitness to the crime, the ability to obtain a conviction is extremely difficult. I know that you had sponsored legislation concerning mandatory jail time on second offenses, and I'd like to see something like that. Unfortunately, I think what will happen is that it will encourage victims to become less inclined to cooperate with us. We have a real difficult time in that sense. And unless one understands the dynamics of domestic violence, it's a very difficult crime to prosecute if you don't have the victim cooperating with you. And I don't have the ability to try to bring in every victim and go over their psychological problems involved, their emotional problems involved, to get their cooperation. I'm limited into our abilities to sit down with the victims. I would hope that there were other resources in the community, and at times there are, but they're limited too, like for counseling for them. But as a result, I try to channel these cases so that I can get a conviction and attempt to rehabilitate these individuals at the misdemeanor level so that the the district attorney's office doesn't face felony cases, which in many cases it happens. That doesn't mean a defendant doesn't get jail time. I mean, if the violence is serious enough and if the defendant is a repeat offender, then we require jail time. But on first offense, usually they don't.
How many of the offenders actually complete the required treatment, and if they don't complete their treatment, what happens to them?
Okay. I believe, at least from talking with the director of the male awareness program, I believe that a majority of them do finish it. I'm not sure. I don't think there's a representative here, but I believe a majority of them finish it. If they don't, what happens to this is, the typical procedure is that if the defendant is in non-compliance with the anchor control program, we are informed through an affidavit. We file what's called a petition to revoke the defendant's probation. When the defendant is brought into court, usually after being arrested, the court inquires as to what reasons the defendant has not complied. If the defendant agrees he has complied, we ask the court to impose jail time, a minimum amount, but jail time, so that the defendant has the message that this is not a game, that we want them to complete the program. If the defendant is then sent back to the program one more time, if on the second try the defendant again non-complies, we do the same thing and bring the defendant back into court, and then at that point ask the court to reimpose all suspended time or to sentence the defendant if it's a first offender and ask that substantial time be imposed. Whether or not the court goes along with that, I mean, what the sentence will be is not, we don't have a choice in that. That's up to the court. But that is the normal procedure. I think we're successful in reducing a majority of, or at least a good portion of the people that we see from going on further. And I know from when I started as a prosecutor, there was nothing like that. And abusers would continue. And I mean, we can sentence them to put them in jail and get them convicted, but that's not rehabilitating. And my goal is to try to rehabilitate. I mean, it doesn't mean that they maybe not should sit in jail, but I think that sitting in jail, for the most part, they usually stew there and continue on with the same concepts they've had before that led to their abusive conduct. So that's what my goal is.
Well, I'm a firm believer in rehabilitation, and I've legislated in that area as well. I'm just concerned about the repeat offender, and that's the reason I'm interested in pursuing the mandatory minimum approach. If you had adequate resources, do you think that it would help?
No. And the reason being that regardless of how much adequate resources we have, most of it depends on the cooperation we have from the victim. In gathering the evidence on what is said in court, and what most of the victims want is, and understandably from the dynamics, want to know is he going to serve any time? Most likely, if it's a repeat offender, we'll probably say yes, he's going to serve time. Then the question is whether we're going to ever see this victim again. We have problems in having a subpoena served on them to testify in court because many of them refuse to testify. In many instances, we then begin to see affidavits being presented to our office indicating that they lied to the officer originally when the officer initially investigated the case, so that a lot of problems start to occur that present problems as far as prosecuting the individual. If there's mandatory jail time, then we advise the defendant that we would have to advise the defendant there is no discretion. Where there is still discretion, we can recommend jail time. Not necessarily that has to be accepted by the defendant. They may still accept the plea requesting the court not to sentence him to jail, but in fact then they eventually do go to jail. But where there is no discretion, they would be more likely to want to contest the case, go to trial. And when we go to trial, Representative Olver, it's always a dice roll as to whether I'm going to get a conviction. And I would like to reduce that gamble.
Thank you. Chief O'Leary, before you start your comments, I've been looking at the report you provided the committee, and it's really quite disturbing looking at the two most serious kinds of violent crime, homicide and rape, where the actual instances have more than doubled in both those categories in the last 2 years. The actual numbers of people arrested seems to be staying about the same, so I'd be really interested in your comments on that. And what kind of resources, if we're getting additional resources dedicated to those areas or not.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, thank you very much for the opportunity to appear before you today to talk about law enforcement in the Anchorage area. To set the tone, approximately 87% of the cases that Steve Branchflower mentioned to you in terms of intake for his office come from the Anchorage Police Department. So the bulk of the felony intake cases and the misdemeanor cases throughout the Anchorage area come from my agency. There's no question there's a tremendous increase in the amount of Part 1 crimes that we're seeing in the Anchorage area. With respect to arrests, with respect to homicide in those areas, we're quite pleased. We've cleared all of our homicide cases with the exception of two at the present time. That's, as of today, there are now 24 homicides versus the 22 you see on there. Sexual assault, we're doing fairly well in our arrests in that area, and clearances and robberies as well. In the last 2 days, we've arrested 11 individuals for armed robbery and two for homicide, four for bank robbery. And we've been very successful in that area. With respect to resources, our resources have been diminished considerably over the last several years. We've lost roughly 60 officers. We've managed to replace some in the last two academies that we've had. But as you're all aware, we had a downturn in the economy, and we have not recovered from that here in Anchorage. Anchorage is still going through a very rigorous belt-tightening process. At the present time, the Assembly is looking at cutting out municipal bus service and libraries and parks and other kinds of things like that that have an impact on the quality of life in the community. With respect to the Anchorage Police Department, we've had to consolidate our resources. I've had to close down units such as our 7-person misdemeanor follow-up unit and transfer them all to patrol. We've taken our 20-person special weapons team, which is a highly trained, proactive unit, and I've blended those folks all back into patrol. Our robbery detail, which is a specialized anti-robbery team, has been blended into our homicide and assault unit because of the large numbers of homicides and assaults, thousands of assaults. Our domestic violence folks, I have two full-time personnel that work that, one in warrants and one in the assault area, and then they work in communion with the officers on patrol, and we respond to thousands of responses for domestic violence service. I think up to this point this year, we've served almost 1,400 domestic violence writs, and we figure it's about a 2 to 3 time response back to those after a writ is served during the course of the process on those. So that's primarily where we're focusing. In the property crimes area, we're focusing on large-scale burglaries, Sears losing $50,000, $100,000 worth